Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Yaron Brook Show. My name is Ilan Jerno. I'm going to be your guest host today. Welcome. So this was a somber week. Friday was 14 years since 9/11. And I always find it a hard week. This is a subject I study and I write about. To me, the anniversary of 9/11 is a bit like remembering a dear friend or a relative who's died. The anniversary is anticipated by a few days. You know it's coming. It's on the edge of your awareness, and then it pops up on you, and all of the feelings that you felt at the time when it happened, and in the years since, come rushing back. It's a difficult time, and to me, I love this country, and I moved here from England many years ago, precisely because I do love this country. And the 9/11 attacks I took very personally. And they affected my career path and my interests. And I find it a difficult time. And I know many of you, it is difficult too. What I want to do today is talk about America and its foreign policy towards the Middle East in the shadow of 9/11 and what kind of things we should learn, things we ought to have learned by now. And just to remember where we are and what we should be doing. One of the things that angers me most about the years since 9/11 is not only that the attacks happened, it's also the way we responded. And this is the subject of the book that I worked on a few years ago called Winning the Unwinnable War. And the anger grows with each year because as I've come to study the issue and understand it in greater depth, America has failed to respond to the threat that showed its face on 9/11 and in the years before. And with each passing year, the problem has become worse. And part of what angers me is that it's well within America's capabilities to respond to this threat and eliminate it. And yet what we're facing now is a 9/11, 14 years later, we're remembering it 14 years later. And the shadow of the Islamist movement, the movement that we saw send people to fly planes into buildings in New York and Washington and in Pennsylvania, that movement is still around and it is still menacing us. And that should be a reality 14 years later is mind-boggling. How that's possible. And the reason that's so strange, you have to keep in mind that America has emerged from the Cold War as the lone superpower. So militarily, in my judgment, America is fully capable of addressing this problem, but we have not. And so that raises an important question, which is, why did things go so wrong since then? And that's what I talk about in my book. And I'm going to plug it one more time now. It's called Winning the Unwinnable War. You can find it on Kindle. And I encourage you to look at it and read it and share it with people who might be interested, because I think it offers a lot of insight onto what happened leading up to 9/11 and what went wrong afterwards. Now, I want to share with you one data point that I read just the other day that I think speaks to some of what needs to be done and talked about regarding 9/11. So I think it's important to remember the people who died. It's important to understand how we got to that situation, how it came about that there was such an attack and that it happened, and then what happened afterwards. But that is a fading memory for many of us. And there are many people who just weren't alive or weren't old enough at the time to remember it. Now, according to a calculation I read in the Washington Post. About a quarter of all Americans alive today were either young at the time to remember 9/11, or they were not yet born. Our population is so young. Now, to me, that just heightens the importance of educating people about the actual story and what happened afterwards. And one of the issues that I write about in the book and that I want to spend a few minutes talking about today is a little understood feature of what went wrong in America's military response to 9/11. And it pertains to the men and women who, many of whom signed up to join the military after 9/11. So they were moved by patriotism, the right kind. They wanted to defend their country, and they believed they would be doing so. And they went to war under President Bush's policy. And the fate of many of them, you know, many died in Iraq and Afghanistan, and needlessly so, in my view. Now, one of the issues that comes up that isn't talked about, I've written a lot about this. It has to do with the moral ideas shaping our response, particularly in the battlefield. So I don't know how many of you have watched the movie American Sniper. I put off watching it because, to me, watching a movie about America's wars after 9/11 is very difficult because I know so much about the history and the background. It's like bringing work home in a way that's just too much. But I took the plunge and I watched the movie, or as much of it as I could. Now, let me just say up front, this is not a movie review of American Sniper. If you love the movie, great. I'm not going to challenge you. If you didn't like the movie, I don't have anything to challenge you there either. And I have to say, I wasn't able to finish watching the movie because it affected me so deeply and so personally. Now, what happens in the movie that brings to mind this issue is in one of the first scenes you see is of the main character, Chris Kyle, who is an amazing sniper. And he is in Iraq and he has to make a decision about whether to shoot what appear to be civilians who might or might not attack an American convoy in the streets. Now, in that one scene, which is one of the tragedies of America's response to 9/11, America's military response. So what happens in the movie is Chris Kyle, you see the backstory, he joins because he wants to defend his country after attacks that happened in 1998 at embassies in Africa and Kenya and Tanzania. And then after 9/11, he's shipped out and he joins the fight in Iraq. So he's exactly the kind of character that many of us know who joined the military after 9/11. Now, he's put in a position of, it's an important job being a sniper and defending his fellow soldiers. But in that one scene, what you get is the crystallization of the battlefield ethics that were in place during the Iraq War, during the Afghanistan War, and which I write about at length in my book, because I think it's important to understand how these battlefield ethics, these rules of engagement, operated, because they're an important part of understanding how the wars were self-crippled, how we as a nation went to war but refused to win it because of the moral ideas we accepted. So what happens in this scene, which it's difficult to relate even, so if you watch the movie, maybe you remember it. He's got his finger on the trigger. He's looking down the barrel of his gun. He's looking through the telescope, and he sees a woman and a boy come out of a building after having witnessed a man on the roof with a cell phone. And he suspects the man on the roof is a spotter, and then he suspects that the woman and the boy are in fact going to carry out an attack on the American convoy. But he doesn't know. And it's the words that one of his fellow soldiers tell him, speaks to him, that I think captures the problem. He whispers to him, this is while Chris Kyle is looking down the barrel of his gun and deciding whether to shoot or not. The soldier right next to him says, if you get this wrong, if you shoot them and they're not planning an attack, you're going to go to Leavenworth. Now, he puts it in a much more colorful way, as you can imagine, the way people speak on the battlefield. But his basic choice is, I'm here to defend my fellow soldiers. I can see what is an objective threat here. The woman is hiding a mortar grenade, I think it is. And then she hands it to the boy. He's seeing the man on the roof. He knows that this is an imminent threat. What does he do? So imagine now you are in that position. Imagine you've come to fight and defend your country, and you put in the battlefield, and you see a threat facing you and facing your fellow soldiers. And if you get it wrong, if you fire at a civilian, even by mistake, you will end up in prison. Now, that multiplied 10,000-fold is the story that many of America's soldiers faced every day in the battlefield. Now, it might seem like, well, surely we want battlefield ethics. Well, yes, you do. You want to have rules governing when soldiers go to fight. But the way in which these rules were structured and organized were self-sacrificial. Now, fortunately, in the movie, this is the part, I don't think this is a spoiler, but in the movie, it turns out that they really are attacking the American troops, and it really is important that he shoot. And that's part of the tragedy of war, which is it requires killing and as part of defending yourself. But what happened in America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other contexts, so these rules of engagement became ever more stringent to the point where, and I think this was true from the beginning, but it just became more and more obvious, these rules were at odds with the goal of defending yourself, of defending America's interests and defending even the lives of the soldiers in the battlefield. Now, I think that this is an issue that has way too little attention. And in part because the rules and the moral ideas shaping the governing view of battlefield ethics. There's basically one dominant view. It's called just war ethics. It's a big body of thinking and debate in academic circles and policy world. And there's basically no other ideas taken seriously in that realm. And the premises of this outlook are essentially self-sacrificial, although it's dressed up in a way to make it sound like you take as great care to avoid civilian casualties while still asserting your defense and ensuring you can defend yourself. But that is in large part window dressing. I mean, it is there to make it seem plausible. But the essence of the view is that the self-interest, the right to self-defense, has to be subordinate to the lives of enemy combatants, and in particularly it's put in terms of civilians, but they have to come first. And that was true across the board. That is a theme that you see throughout America's conduct in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Whenever I speak to audiences on college campuses, when I speak to community groups in Capitol Hill, I talk to people, and at least one person usually comes up and tells me, my dad was in Iraq, I was in Iraq. Someone they know came back, and this was their daily grind. They were constantly pulled in two directions. Their job, an important job, was to go after the bad guys. But what they had to do, they couldn't do because their hands were tied. And they oftentimes would have to suffer incredible and not respond. Now, this isn't an account of everything that went wrong with the response to 9/11. This is an important feature, a fundamental, important moral failing that colors the whole policy. There's more to say about what went wrong, and I encourage you again, look at my book, Winning the Unwinnable War. But this is such a crucial issue that people really don't appreciate that America went to war and prevented its soldiers from doing their job because of the moral ideas that dominate, the self-sacrificial moral ideas that have pervaded the military establishment and that are taken as obvious, as a given. Now, this is something that here at the Ayn Rand Institute, where I work and where Yaron Brook works, he's our CEO, this is one of the issues we've stood up and made people aware of, because I think it's vital to see that the moral ideas that govern an issue, that underlie it, are really important and that they shape the decision and have incredible consequences. Now, you might also know the story of Bill Iver, which is something I mentioned briefly in my book as well. That is actually the same theme where America sends Navy SEALs into Afghanistan to go after a Taliban fighter, and they have this really impossible choice. They are confronted by shepherds who may or may not be on the side of the Taliban, and the military decision, the right thing to do with the goal of self-defense, is to capture them, put them away, maybe even kill them, because you can't trust that they won't go and let the enemy know where the SEAL team is. But because of the fear that they would be punished for harming civilians in combat, the SEALs have to do the so-called right thing, which is they let them go. And the story is called Lone Survivor. It's a true story. The story is called Lone Survivor because only one of the team survived after the ambush that the Taliban carried out. So this, again, it's this phenomenon of a battlefield ethics that undermines the goal of self-defense. Now, I've written about this, as I mentioned. Let me give you a few other examples just to kind of flesh out this issue, the wider principle here. So I've told you about the fictionalized scenario with Chris Kyle in American Sniper. I've told you about the SEAL Team 6 in the story in the movie and the book Lone Survivor. Here are a few other things, and these are taken from a study, a psychological study that was published by the U.S. government of combat veterans, the battlefield experience of American troops in Iraq. Here are some of the things that they encountered and that they were prohibited by the battlefield ethics, the rules of engagement, from doing anything about. They had to turn the other cheek, in other words. So they're driving around in Iraq, and suddenly Molotov cocktails are thrown at them. Now, a Molotov cocktail is a glass bottle with some combustible material inside, usually gasoline, with a rag in it, and when it hits, it explodes. It's like a primitive grenade, and it's thrown at your vehicle. What do? You just have to turn the other cheek. Or suppose you drive under a bridge, and suddenly huge chunks of concrete fall down from the bridge onto your car. What do? You have to drive by. You're not allowed to respond. Or what happens if you are being shot at, but the sniper is holed up in a mosque? Now, a mosque happens to be on the long, long, long list of no-strike zones. So you can't go after him. You have to turn back and just let the sniper fire at you. Now, it sounds crazy, and you might say, oh, this is cherry-picking. I assure you, the more you look into this, the more you realize the extent to which the military's capabilities were hamstrung. Their hands were tied behind their back. So even to the extent, and we can debate the Iraq war, I don't think it was the right war, but if you go to Iraq, if you send people into battle and you think there's some threat to eliminate, you have to let them do that. That was precisely what the rules of engagement, the dominant self-sacrificial battlefield ethics, prevented them from doing that. Imagine the psychological damage that does to the soldiers, how it affects their morale. In fact, one of the quotes you will find if you go into the research for the psychological study I mentioned that the Pentagon put out is that the every group of soldiers and Marines that they interviewed, and they found hundreds and hundreds of combat veterans, every one of them said they felt that the existing rules of engagement tied their hands, that's a direct quote, tied their hands, preventing them from doing what needed to be done to win the war, unquote. Now, that is from the mouth of the soldiers who were actually there. Now, I'm stressing this because I think you can't begin to understand what went wrong after 9/11 without understanding the way in which the war and the policies we pursued there were colored by the wrong moral ideas. And that is a significant part of the argument I make in my book, Winning the Unwinnable War. Now, this was all brought to mind as I was watching American Sniper, the movie. And I had to say, I had to turn off the movie. It angered me so much. And because it reminded me of the injustice that was done to the American troops who were sent into battle, and many of them died. And I think many of those who died did so because they were prevented from defending themselves. And when you have rules that contradict the moral imperative of self-defense, when you have to ask, not question the integrity of the soldiers, which is often what you see. You see that the disgrace is all these soldiers didn't live up to the rules of engagement. What you should do is challenge the premise, is challenge the rules of engagement themselves and ask, then and why are these the rules? And since when is this the way to conduct a war? If there's a legitimate purpose to the war, then it has to be done in a way that actually serves that purpose. And the rules of war, so-called, or the international laws of war, which is a variation on this issue, same principles apply, but governing different kinds of conduct. Those are what have to be challenged. My argument then is that we need to challenge the moral ideas that shaped the war, not just the goals and day-to-day conduct. So, I mean, the bottom line is, I think if you want to understand what went wrong in Iraq and what went wrong in Afghanistan, yes, it's important to understand a lot of the operational failures and mistakes and lack of planning and all those things. There's real problems in how that was done. The wider problems were that the goals of the war were irrational. I think the idea of bringing democracy to the Middle East was not the right goal. It was not serving America's interests. I argue that in the book. And then when you drill down into the actual conduct of the war, how it was carried out, you see that there was a huge injustice done to those Americans, many of whom signed up after 9/11 and who wanted to defend their country, but were prevented from doing so. And that is a huge disgrace. Now, in my view, that has to be understood. Now, there is a kind of, I don't know, it's not even somber, it is perverse in its own way, a riff on this, which is now, so these rules of engagement, it's important to see that they were routinely ratcheted up and made more and more stringent. And you can understand why, because each time there's civilian casualties, which are unavoidable and unwelcome feature of war, but each time those happen, the conclusion wasn't, hey, what are we doing here? The conclusion was, well, the rules aren't stringent enough and people aren't following them enough, so let's make it even tighter. So here's what happened now. So as you probably know, America is involved in combating the Islamic State, or ISIS as it's called, in Iraq through air attacks. Now, here's what the Iraqis on the ground, who are part of the Iraqi military, such as it is and whatever's left of it, here's what they're saying. They're saying that the rules of engagement that America is operating under while bombing ISIS are way, way too restrictive, and it's enabling ISIS to dodge the bombs, in effect. So the bombing now that's being carried out, to the extent you agree with it, and I think to the extent that it is even remotely close to what should be done, even that is hamstrung. And it's not my telling you this. It's the Iraqis themselves who are calling in the airstrikes. They're saying, look, the ISIS fighters know what's going to happen. They know where the safe zones are, where the no-strike zones are. And they know that if they embed themselves among civilians, they will get away with it. And that's exactly what is happening. So even now, 14 years after 9/11, 10 plus years after the invasion of Iraq and the disastrous Bush policy that we saw exhibited there, even now with the rules of engagement such as they are, it's still the case that America's military contribution to fighting ISIS from the air is itself again affected by these rules of engagement. Now, this goes to a wider point, which is we haven't learned one of the most important lessons following 9/11 and the response to it, which is that our conduct, our war in response was sabotage, was self-sabotage by the moral ideas we accepted. It was a self-crippled war. And that, to me, is one of the most important lessons we need to understand and make sure people weren't around at 9/11 and too young to remember and who will need to understand these lessons in the future. That is an important point they need to accept and see. So I hope your 9/11 was a time of reflection, that you spent some time thinking about what is good about America and what an injustice was done to us, and that your resolve to combat the enemies that we still face has been hardened by that. And I'll encourage you to think more about it, and if you speak up and talk to people, is to have them rethink some of their views, because the views and the conclusions people have drawn after 9/11 are really muddled, and the most important lessons, the role of moral ideas in what our war should have looked like and what it actually looked like, those lessons have not been learned. So after a brief break, I want to turn to the main topic today, which is what to make of Obama's Mideast policy. So I've been talking a lot about what I think of Bush's policy, and that was the subject of my book, and I've been sketching out what that looked like in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, let's turn to the current incumbent about what to make of Obama. There's a lot to say, and we'll be right back after these messages.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense class.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking at...
All right, welcome back. So let's turn to that main question, what to make of Obama's Mideast policy. So I have a view that the discussion of how to evaluate a president's foreign policy is difficult to do, and it's too easy. And I hear a lot of well-meaning people fall into this trap. They hear something offhand on Fox News, or they hear something on MSNBC that resonates with them, and that starts to build their view, and so they become a kind of echo of what they've heard. And I think you can pick up bits and pieces that way, but I don't think that's the way to form a view. I think the right way to form a view is to look at the actual record, look at the data, and to form a first-hand perspective. Now, it takes time, and I know not everyone is that motivated to do it, but that is essential, because part of what one has to recognize is when you are listening to analysis of foreign policy, and particularly just actual events happening now day-to-day in real time, when you're listening to that, it's presented to you often with a certain embedded moral premise or moral premises. And unless you untangle them, it's hard to sort out, well, what's actually happening and what do I think about it? And what I think about it means, what conclusions do I draw? What evaluation would I draw based on my values? And that doesn't mean the values that you get from conventional commentators and conventional discussions. And here's kind of an example of what I mean, which is there's all kinds of assumptions embedded in the analysis you hear about Obama and even of Bush that you have to question. So I'm going to dig into some of the arguments pro and con, and then I want to work through a few examples of big issues and then evaluate Obama's approach. So kind of the headline point here is, it's way too easy for people on the right and the kind of self-described people on the right and people who vote for the Republican Party, whatever their particular self-definition is, it's way too easy to look at Obama and say, he's the world's worst president on foreign policy. He's destroyed America's standing in the world. The end. And there's some truth to that. I don't think Obama's policy has been good, but has it been worse than George Bush? And part of what you hear from people on the right is, well, look, Bush did some bad things, but he kind of mended Iraq when he left. You know, there was the surge which brought down the violence. And so it was all going in the right direction until Obama took the oath of office, and then all hell broke loose. Now, I think that is it's a tendentious view. It's really warped by a kind of what you might call petty partisanship of we want to defend our guy and his legacy, meaning Bush, and we want to bash Obama because he's not our guy. There's a kind of tribalist mentality behind it. None of that. And so you get examples that are cherry picked. What you get is a dropping of the historical context of what actually happened with Bush and how it is relevant. And there's certain ways in which it's inescapable to think about and evaluate the Bush legacy in order to understand Obama and his foreign policy decisions and evaluate him. That doesn't mean that Bush's legacy exculpates or kind of gives Obama a pass. That's not the way to think about it. But it's equally wrong to drop that entire context and pretend, as many people who are kind of boosters or surrogates for the Republican Party would like to do, say, if it were everything bad started when Obama came in, which is so far from the truth. Now, on the other side, on kind of the liberal / democratic / whatever you want to call it, opponent side, what you get is Bush made such a mess of things, no one could have done anything different and better than Obama. And even so, he was the tonic we needed, but he was hamstrung. He wasn't allowed to do what he needed to do. So we have to give him a pretty good rating, but the shortcomings that he faced and the things that he didn't accomplish that he promised to do, well, you know where the blame for that lies. It's the people who are trying to trip him up and who are just too benighted, too parochial to understand how the world really works. Now, that, again, I don't know if you've heard that, but you just need to turn on MSNBC or some of the other channels and just read the New York Times, which I do and I find fascinating. But you get a certain kind of echo chamber effect where Obama was the redeemer in chief who came in, and in, at every step, people were trying to trip him up. And so, yeah, he did some things that didn't work out, but, well, he was trying to do the right thing. Now, that, again, is not the way to think about these issues. That is a kind of after-the-fact rationalization for you want to make your guy out to look better than he is. And, again, there are important facts that are dropped out of the context. Now, that's not a way to think about the issue. And it won't give you any clarity or any means of advocating the right views or just understanding, let alone advocating. Because I think that has to be the starting point. So I just want to make a pitch for it. That's not the way to think about it. And if you hear it, be extra critical when you're looking at things and listening to the arguments about how to evaluate presidents and their records. Because those things so often are colored and designed to reach a certain conclusion. They're not real thinking, or they're rarely real thinking, and they're rarely real analysis. They're way too often just post hoc justifications for our side, and here I'm using air quotes. You should have one side when you're thinking, which is what's the truth? What's actually happening in the world? Whether or not you voted for the commander-in-chief, whether or not you voted for his predecessor, those are important facts, but they're not central to understanding what actually happened. So the primary is on the truth and the facts of the world, and then put them up against the standard of your values. What do you think the world needs to look like? What are your principles? And it's important to have a view of those. And that is a big responsibility. Now, my view, and you know, I work at the Ayn Rand Institute, and as the show is called Radicals for Capitalism, Yaron and I share this view. We stand for the principle of freedom, and we have a definite view of what that looks like politically. It means a laissez-faire society. It means that the principle governing that shapes government should be individual rights, properly understood, as the exclusive function of government. So there's a lot that cuts out. And I'm sure if you're a regular listener to Yaron's show, you've come to form a view of what some of those principles are. Now, it's important to know your principles so you have some control of your thinking and understand, have a view of how to approach certain issues. So you need the facts and you need your principles. Now, obviously that's not enough. You need to kind of dig into the material. So what I want to do is start sketching out, well, what exactly are the issues that Obama promised to deal with? What are the analyses you hear about him and what people say he did well, he didn't do well, and what's actually going on, leaving aside those arguments? Because I think there's two issues here. One is, what do people say? What is the debate over Obama's record, and which is itself interesting? And then what is the actual record, and what do you think of it? So let's start with what are the arguments people make and how do you judge them? Now let's set some context. So when did Obama come in and what was the mood? And so he came in, he swept in on this euphoric tide of hope and change. And these are, you know, big abstract terms without any substance at the time. And on domestic issues, it's not clear what things were going to it's not clear that people who voted for him and were moved to do so had any idea what he was going to do. But if you turn to the foreign policy side of it, and here it was more obviously substantive things that you could pick out. Now, there's definitely things on the domestic side you could pick out. He was talking about what became Obamacare, and he had priorities, but that wasn't really the focus of the campaign in the same way that his foreign policy positions were essentially, I'm going to undo all the bad things George W. Bush did. And that, I think, was a big part of his appeal. And rightly, because President George W. Bush made really bad policy decisions. And he steered this country's foreign policy into the ground after 9/11. There's a reality to what made Obama popular. And there was so you can understand people saying, "Oh, I don't want to, I don't want another Bush. So give me anything but Bush." And not only was Obama standing as anything but Bush. Now there's a certain trend in American presidential politics of the on the campaign trail, everyone, there's definitely this pattern of, I'm going to be different from the last guy. And then they come into office and they try to find point for point things that are going to be different. So it's not a new phenomenon. You can see Clinton was going to be not George H.W. Bush, and George Bush was going to be not Clinton. And so you see this pattern. But with Obama, that has so much more force because of the enormous dissatisfaction, which was in part justified, against George Bush's policy. So there's a reality to why Obama had a certain appeal on foreign policy when he came in. Now, there's some reality to that. Now, when he came in, what he promised to do was basically, now notice how this is framed. He promised to undo the stain of America's conduct in the war. And his view was America was way too self-assertive. This is part of the narrative about torture and detentions. Now, there's definitely things I disagree with in the way America conducted the war, including the surveillance that still carried out. And so there's definitely things to criticize, but the way it was conceptualized is interesting, which is America went way too far in asserting itself. And so here, Iraq was a war of choice. In a certain way, that's true. But what was meant by Obama and people who supported him was that there really was not a significant threat. We shouldn't have really asserted ourselves. Now, they would have been, I think, equally as opposed to the right war, which in my view should have been directed at Iran, and for reasons which I talk about in my book and in other places. So there's a way in which what was the point of opposition was America asserted itself. Now, the fact that it was Iraq, I think, was relevant, but not central. So there was this idea that what went wrong was Bush was too concerned with America's self-interest. He went overboard. Iraq was a disaster as a result. We did all kinds of stuff that lost us prestige and moral standing in the world. And so Obama's priorities were end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that was such a disaster, and you can see there's definitely things to say about why those war were a disaster and that they should have been dealt with, but not as Obama promised to do. And there's definitely things that we did that undermined our moral standing. Now, I think for totally different reasons than Obama. Obama believed we were too self-assertive. And my view is we were not self-assertive enough. We didn't have a conception of what our self-interest really was and what the enemy is, whom we should be targeting, and so on. Now, so you see there's actual facts in the world that you would point to as things that were done badly. But then how to interpret them and the reasons and explaining what was bad about them, that was completely misconceptualized. And so what you see is Obama comes in and his agenda is point for point undo Bush's wars. And then the positive side of his agenda is he's going to pursue just three, maybe four priorities. I'm only going to talk about three today. And those priorities, in his views, are the highest priorities for resetting America's orientation to the world. What were they? Well, number one is reconciling with, and you want to put it more bluntly, is making amends for our self-assertion with respect to the Muslim world community. And I put it as Muslim world community because it's not really culture. We're not really responding to religion. It's this idea of all Muslims everywhere, regardless of borders. We've done wrong by them. They feel embattled. Obama is going to walk in and correct that. That's number one. And there's things to say about that conceptualization. Is that even a problem? How do you, what to think of that? Is it a priority for the president and so forth? Number two was the highest priority, or second, right up there in terms of priorities, is he's going to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Okay, well, that should be sort of a shocker, because in what way is that central to the chaos in the Middle East? Well, it's an interesting question. I'll get to that in a minute. That was number two. Number three is, as part of reconciling with the Muslim world community, there's a sub-point under that, which is addressing Iran's nuclear ambitions or making nice with Iran, finding some accommodation with them. So the three priorities after cleaning up Bush's mess were resetting relations with the Muslim world, fixing the Arab-Israeli conflict, and their Iran policy, and in particular the nuclear issue. Now, I want to talk about each of these in turn. But let's start by looking at, is this even a problem? So the essential issue here is, Obama's view was the Iraq war, the Afghanistan war, led people in the Muslim world, or the Middle East more specifically, think that America was after them, was going to attack them because of their religion and so forth. Now, that is not even remotely true. So if you're looking at it just in terms of facts, never mind what they feel is the case, what is actually the case? As bad as Bush's policies were, he bent over backwards to distinguish between Islam and terrorism. And in fact, it was days after the 9/11 attacks when President Bush went out of his way to praise Islam and to call it a religion of peace. So there's no basis on which to say that America's policies were calculated a war on Islam. That is just nonsense. The fact that Iraq and Afghanistan are both majority Muslim countries does not make it a war on Islam. Now, why does Obama and many people, not just he, have the view that we have to convince the Muslim world that we're not at war with them? Well, I think that part of the explanation here is Obama is adopting, perhaps unwittingly, he's adopting the moral premises of the enemy. He's accepting as a premise that there is this clash, which is the premise of the jihadists. The jihadists' view is their religion is embattled by the forces of unbelief, which includes Christians, Jews, atheists, and that as the problem is they need to spread their religion to make things right in the world and rebuild their glory. Now, that I don't think Obama would admit to it, or many people might not even recognize that this is the case, but that puts the moral framework for what's happening in the terms the enemy claims are true, and they're not true. I mean, so basically he's saying, you're hearing from all the jihadists that there's a war in Islam. I just want to make sure you know it's not true. Well, by doing that, he's conceding and giving some credence to that premise, which is just completely a concession. So in my view, the issue of reconciling with the Muslim world is inherently appeasing to the enemy context, the jihadist context, and it is patronizing to the people who are listening to it. Because the more thoughtful one is, the more one would recognize that the real problems in the Middle East are not with some supposed war on Islam. The problems have to do with the beliefs and the political dynamics within the region, which is endemic tyranny of various kinds, strongman, dictatorship, theocracy, tribalism, where people fight over their identities and their religious beliefs, sectarianism. And you can keep going, but the basic problems in the region have a lot more to do with the beliefs and doctrines and cultural patterns that are indigenous than they have to do with any primarily American conduct in the region. So in effect, Obama's starting point in terms of a priority, and you have to read some of his speeches, which I've been doing lately. Some of his inauguration speech and the first few speeches he gave in his first 100 days, he gave a speech first in Turkey, and then his landmark speech in Cairo in June of 2009. And this was supposed to be his opening of, we're going to be friends with the rest of the world, and particularly the Muslim world. You have to read it closely, and what you see when you do that is that his basic premise is, we've done a lot of bad things to upset you. Let me come and be the one to make amends. Now that, I suggest, and I think the facts are on my side, entirely inverted. And it drops a wider context. It completely ignores the context of both what is causing that part of the world to be so backward politically and economically, which is it's the lack of freedom and the lack of innovation and independence and political and economic freedom are the primaries. And there's a lot to say about what is preventing that part of the world from becoming free. That is the primary. And in framing the whole issue as, you guys have a legitimate gripe against us, that puts us on the defensive. It means we have to win them over, as opposed to, these are the facts. You guys have a bad. The world that you live in is backwards. You have third world level poverty and worse. You have backwardness, ignorance, and you need to, if you want a better life, here are the sort of things you need to do. Instead of treating it frankly and treating people as adults, it's patronizing and condescending to say, yeah, we've done a lot of bad things to you, so no wonder you're upset with us. Let me be the one to bridge the gulf. And he insists that it's his job to be this bridge between the two worlds, between the West and Islam. Now, that is completely bizarre. I mean, it's nothing to do with the facts of the case. And it comes instead from what I think of as guilt. Guilt for the fact of American success. Guilt for the fact that America is economically powerful, militarily powerful. And it's an unearned guilt. Now, where would you get that kind of guilt complex, or that kind of unearned guilt? And I think it has to do with some of the moral ideas that are shaping American culture. And that is that if you're successful, well, you must have done something bad along the way. If you're wealthy, well, maybe you stepped on a lot of people's backs to get there. And there's this inherent suspicion of success. Now, we're not as bad as the Europeans on this kind of issue. We do admire successful people. But there is this strong undercurrent, this moral belief that those who are successful are somehow guilty for it. And they should do penance for those who are not successful. And seriously, if you want to find a part of the world that is really unsuccessful, you only need to go to the Middle East in terms of economic, political, and cultural backwardness. And this does not mean that I think the people there are inherently bad. It's not an attack on them, and it's not a racist attack. It has to do with the cultural institutions and the values that are dominant and that hold people back. Because I would love for that part of the world to be really flourishing. And I think it would require there to be greater freedom for the people there, real individualism. So it's not an attack on individual people. It's an attack on their ideas that dominate and hold people back. So point one of Obama's aim to reset the context with the Muslim world, it is misconceived. It is guilt-ridden and unearned guilt. And it is condescending. It is self-sacrificial in the sense of appeasing the enemy's context and the enemy's perspective on this issue. And worse, in a certain way, is that there's nothing the American president can do to make things right with people who are hostile to him and whose values are at odds with American values and who are not going to change those values because he's going to abase himself and kneel down and bow and try to give them a self-esteem pep talk, which is what the Cairo speech from 2009 amounts to. And he goes into the history of how Islamic culture contributed to the Western science and so on. And a lot of that is true. That is not grounds for people today in Cairo's slums to feel good about themselves. What they need to feel good about themselves is actual achievement, to live in freedom. They need science. They need to accomplish things and do so by their own means. So that was a non-starter to begin with, and an embarrassment. So I don't think you should even hold this as a standard. Did he succeed in resetting the standard with the Muslim world? That is not a legitimate goal. And it was embarrassing that he set it as a goal. So let me say on the second point, the solving of the Arab-Israeli conflict, because I think this is one of the more fascinating features of his administration. What he said at the beginning is this: look, we're going to make it a priority and act on it immediately. So I'm going to appoint a special envoy. His name is George Mitchell, who's got this long history of solving conflicts. He was involved in solving or settling parts of the Northern Ireland conflict, and I'm not sure that went as well as people claim. But the premise on Obama's side is the analysis of what Bush failed to do in resolving this conflict was he didn't act soon enough and he didn't invest enough resources. Now, if you can believe that, it probably means, and without insulting you, you haven't really thought about what the Arab-Israeli conflict is about, nor what has failed in the attempts to solve it. That to call Obama's premise that, well, we haven't done enough to invest and push the two sides into talks, to regard that as an explanation is to give the concept of superficial and is to insult the superficiality. There's two things to note here. The Arab-Israeli conflict is not well understood, even kind of in the establishment foreign policy world. That's one point. It's a complex issue, and I'll talk about it perhaps in future shows, and I've talked about it in past shows when Yaron was the host. But the important thing to get is that it is essentially a clash between two sides, one of which actually represents the ideas of freedom and Western progress, which is Israel. And it has flaws and problems, and let me register those here, but it is head and shoulders above all the other countries in the region. And I have severe criticisms of Israel, and yet I think it's head and shoulders. And on the other side of this, you have the Palestinian cause represented at different times by different groups, but its essential organizing principle is to build a society of tyranny, just like the ones across the border throughout the Middle East. And now it's been nationalist tyranny under the PLO period. Now it's become Islamist tyranny. But the common denominator is tyranny and subjugation. And then it's part of what drives the movement's goal of liquidating Israel. Now, that might not be convincing. That's just my summary of my view. And there's a lot more to say to justify that. So you don't take it on my authority, but just that's my view. And if you have that kind of clarity, you understand that the peace attempts in the past, what failed in the past, failing to recognize the moral inequality between the two sides, that the one side actually stands for freedom, the other side stands for the destruction of freedom. Now, to regard, so that's completely missing from Obama's view, and it was missing from Bush's view. I think he did enormous damage in making the conflict worse. But Obama's putting it as a high priority is revealing in two ways. One is that he doesn't get what's really happening, which There's a real moral difference between these two sides. And the second way in which it's revealing is that he sees it, and he said this, and so did others of his administration say this, as the crux, the central conflict in the region. Let that sink in for a second. Now, this is in 2009. Now, he said he had this view in 2011, in 2013, in 2014, and he still has this view. This is the central conflict of all the region. Now, if you just rifle through a book of history of the Middle East, you'll see an inordinate number of conflicts and wars and civil wars that have nothing to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are many more wars that were independent of that conflict than there are wars that arose between Israel and its Arab enemies. So just as a matter of factual history, it is not numerically the most violent war. It's not even the most bloody war. It's not even the longest war. It pales in comparison, for example, with the sectarian fighting between the Sunni and the Shiite factions within Islam. And you saw that in Iraq during the civil war. It pales in comparison with just look at the Syrian civil war that is now causing incredible numbers of human incredible numbers of migrants into Europe just fleeing from the disaster that is Syria. The premise that Israel-Palestinian conflict is the crux of the conflict is actually a premise that you hear. I mean, it's pretty common in the foreign policy establishment, and it's common in the Arab world, and they share the premise, which is Israel is basically the problem, and if only we could address it, then all the problems of the region will take care of themselves. This is a view, and it's sometimes labeled the linkage theory. And it's basically, you heard this in the 1950s and 60s when Egypt had its moment when it was trying to rally the Arab world under the heading of Arab nationalism. And the leader at the time, Gamal Abdel Nasser, would give these long, blood-curdling speeches about how Israel is the cancer in the region because it's obstructing the unity of all Arabs. And he went to war with Israel twice. Now, that idea of Israel as the impediment and the source of conflict in the region, it's completely skewed to the context of what the Arab and specifically the Palestinian narrative wants the world to believe. It is a significant conflict. I don't mean to underplay that, but it is far and away not the central conflict, and resolving it would do good, but it's not going to resolve the civil war in Syria. It's not going to resolve the war that you see between the regime in Egypt and its people. It's not going to solve all the conflicts we've seen erupt independently of it in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring. So just factually, the idea that the Arab-Israeli conflict is the central conflict is wrong. And it's wrong to assume, as Obama did, that the way to resolve it is to bring the two sides into negotiations, because the record on that has been continual concessions on the part of Israel, continual pocketing of those concessions on the Palestinian side, and ever-increasing militancy. I mean, just 10 years ago, last month, Israel withdrew unilaterally from the Gaza Strip. Now, the story behind this is a bit complicated, but the gist of the story is, for many years, as part of the negotiations to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, Israel was told, just make more concessions, give more land, and you'll get more peace. This is all the Palestinians want. Yada, 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 right? So, and I don't mean to make light of it, but so finally it was put to a test, like a laboratory condition. This was a unilateral concession of territory. In other words, there was no expectation and no request for a quid pro quo. There was nothing the Palestinians had to do to get this land. So this was outside of that negotiation sphere. So it's basically, if it's really true that they want land and this will bring peace, well, let's just give them a whole bunch of land and let's see what happens. What happened? So Israel withdrew every last Israeli citizen from Gaza. All the military went outside. And what happened was Gaza was taken over eventually by the Hamas faction, which is an Islamist faction, and has become, as predicted, and as anyone could have predicted, it's become a militant mini-state that has launched two wars against Israel. So the idea of land for peace was tested so many times, and even outside of negotiations. So the record of the Arab-Israeli conflict peace negotiations should give anyone pause for thought that, okay, this is, number one, is not the central conflict for resolving the Middle East. And number two, we can't try what we've been trying that's failed so often. So here again, you see the context that is informing Obama's priorities was wrong. And indeed, he sent John Kerry in to try to bring the two sides together, and that failed. And what came afterwards in terms of restarting the peace talks, it failed. And there was the Gaza war last summer. Now, I mention this because it's crucial to see that if you keep trying the same thing over and over again, and in every past instance it failed and failed disastrously, the idea of redoing it should strike people as, well, that's crazy. I mean, you keep hitting your head against the wall and you get a bruise. So you're going to keep hitting your head against the wall and hoping you won't get a bruise? Now, it should be bizarre that that's even an option, let alone that it's a priority. So, and so if you're keeping score, no, I don't think he solved the Arab-Israeli conflict. In fact, I think there's reason to think it made things much worse. And there's more to say about that, and perhaps another time we'll get into it in more depth. But it's important to get that it's bizarre that this was a priority, and it was bizarre in part because to think that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the central issue is to miss what? It's to miss the growing trend across decades of the Islamist descent, their rise to power across the region, and particularly after George Bush's administration, which through its promotion of elections across the Middle East brought Islamists ever greater power, both in the Palestinian territories, in Iraq, in Lebanon. So just the recent history of what the predecessor did in the region should lead people to think, wait a minute, we used to think the Arab-Israeli conflict was the big thing, the core issue. But wait a minute, look at all these Islamists coming to power. Look at all their kind of galvanized marching in the streets. That is what you ought to be looking at, and not this story about how if only Israel mended its ways regarding the Palestinians, everything would be hunky-dory. That's crazy. I mean, there's arguments about what Israel's policy should be and what is its culpability for its policies and so on. But the idea that that is the hinge on which all the conflict is happening, that's just divorced from reality. And the ignoring or the downplaying of the jihadist movement as a rising problem, that's a moral crime. It's completely negligent. Okay, so the final thing I want to mention in terms of Obama's priorities and in terms of how to think about judging his administration is the idea of reconciling with Iran and the idea that clearly, you know, Iran pursuing nuclear weapons is a problem. We want to avoid that and so on. So on this point, there's a key issue to recognize, which is this is an actual priority. So unlike the first two that I was criticizing regarding reconciling and appeasing the so-called Muslim world community and the Arab-Israeli conflict, which I think is important, but it's not the priority that he made it out to be. The Iran issue is a problem, and it deserves attention. And in fact, I think this is one of the failings of the George Bush administration, which was, apart from some loose rhetoric, which he quickly abandoned, George W. Bush launched a so-called war on terror, but did nothing about the world's most active state sponsor of terror, which is Iran, which I think for those reasons and other reasons should have been the focus of our response to 9/11. And so it's good that Iran is the priority. So let's give credit to Obama for making that something as top three of his foreign policy priorities. But I think that's where we have to stop with the praise, because after you get into the details of what he thinks Iran is as a regime, what his view of the character of Iran, and what needs to happen in terms of our response to it, that's when you return to what I think of as fantasy land. So this is the world of make-believe and wishful thinking. this is the world in which Iran has all kinds of grievances against us, which we have to take seriously, and in which our responsibility is to reach out to them. And in his inaugural speech, and then in subsequent speeches, you keep hearing the same talking point. Obama said, "We will offer you a hand in friendship if you unclench your fist." And yeah, I'm sure you've heard that from him. And so what does that exactly mean? So we're going to have to take the initiative to reconcile with Iran. Now, the backstory is since 1979, 1980, the U.S. and Iran have had no official kind of formal diplomatic relations. We ejected their ambassador from the United States. And the reason was that after the Iranian Revolution, the Iranian regime backed the hostage-taking of America's diplomats in Tehran, and there was a huge, humiliating embarrassment for America. Diplomats taken hostage for 444 days. Now, that was a major break in the relationship. And since then, Iran has fostered attacks and worked hand in glove with terrorists to harm Americans, to kill Americans. There's a great deal of blood on its hands. Now, that's just a snapshot of the backstory. To think that now it is on us, the initiative we have to shoulder in order to reconcile with Iran, that is a complete inversion. And the idea that Iran has some grounds for clenching its fist, because the implication of that metaphor is, well, they have reasons to have their hands clenched, right? We've done things. No wonder they're uptight. No wonder they're kind of edgy. Well, that again is completely wrong. So Iran initiated an attack on America's embassy. Iran initiated attacks on American targets in Lebanon and around the world. So again, it is an appeasing approach towards Iran. And it's notable, again, it's fascinating to read Obama's early speeches now in light of the Iran deal. Because one of the things that he did at the time is a real concerted effort to reach out to Iran and open diplomatic channels in a way that really astounding, kind of the extent to which Obama made overtures. And of course, for the first few years, Iran continually hung up the phone and slammed the door in his face and insulted us. And they continued to insult us, but they insulted every one of these openings. But one of the things Obama does early on is to make the case that Iran is just misunderstood. They belong in the community of nations. They've become estranged, and we just need to repair the relationship. I mean, we just need to, if there were some equivalent of family therapy for international relations, this would be it. So we just need to come together, work out our differences, and, you know, after that, we can talk about the nuclear issue and get that sorted out. And by the way, as part of talking about the nuclear issue, up front, Obama said, you know, we recognize your right to have peaceful nuclear technology. Now, the premise there is that Iran is basically on par, morally, with every other country that has nuclear technology and deserves to have nuclear power if it needs it and so on. Now, that means, so just flesh that out. What does that mean? That Iran is morally on par with, say, the United Kingdom, which has real freedom, just, you know, very controlled economy. It is a really free country, has nuclear technology, both nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, and that Iran is just basically like another UK, just happens to be in the Middle East and happens to be upset with us. So no wonder they're kind of clenching their fists. Now, that is, I think, a way to understand the premises behind his outlook. And again, when you look at the reality of Iran, what you see is that it's nothing like on par with the United Kingdom or any free country. It is a theocracy. It is a architect of terror and a funder of terror. It is a brutal, brutal dictatorship of its own people. There's no dissent in Iran. If you look at the so-called elections of 2009, when the Iranian regime slaughtered its own people in the streets, this is a an immoral regime, has no legitimacy to stay in power. And yet at every turn, Obama is offering them praise and acknowledgement and the openness and recognition as a worthy interlocutor, someone to sit around the negotiating table and talk about with. So fast forward to Obama's pride. So if you are looking at the way people evaluate him, one of the signal achievements we are told that people will point to in the future is Obama's nuclear deal with Iran. And this came about in the last 2 years worth of negotiations, which began 2013 and it culminated this summer with the deal that was struck and that presumably, who knows exactly when this will come about, but it looks as if it's going to happen. I don't think the Congress is going to be able to stop it here in the U.S. So it looks as if it's going to come together. So the deal now is culminating, and this, Obama has said, is the way to stop Iran's nuclear program. It guarantees that Iran won't have access to nuclear weapons technology and won't be able to advance and so on. So this is, we've solved it through a triumph of diplomacy. We didn't have to go to war the way Bush did. Now, certainly I wouldn't encourage anyone to go to war the way Bush did. And if those are options, yeah, I don't want what Bush did. Nobody should want that. But that's a false alternative. And worse than that, it is riddled with deceptions on what the deal is and what Iran is. So a negotiated deal with a country like Iran, on the face of it, it's inadmissible. There's no basis for having that kind of agreement. There's no grounds for trusting Iran. And it's specifically because of its character, its moral character as a theocracy that is openly hostile to us. Now, and not just before the nuclear deal, even after the nuclear deal. And that's one of the things you will see more of, which is at every opportunity, Iran's leaders are trumpeting the deal because they think it's a win for them. And it is a win for them as a means of getting what they want and sticking a finger in the eye of the U.S. Because at every point they're telling us, which we ought to know, that Iran and the U.S. remain enemies, because Iran views us as the so-called great Satan. And this is all only kind of a technicality. They're going to comply with it if they feel like it. They're going to set the red lines for what it looks like to violate the deal. And we just have to go along with it. Now, the deal itself is it's predicated on treating Iran as if it were not a hostile country. All these other things that we know they do, and that the administration, that John Kerry, Barack Obama themselves have said publicly, will continue to be problems, like the funding of terrorist groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah. That's going to continue. The deal is not going to solve that. The funding of insurgents all over the Middle East in Yemen and it's supporting the Taliban now and Afghanistan, all that's going to continue. Yep, no, the deal is not going to stop that. Its hostility to Israel and its demands to wipe Israel off the map. Yep, that's going to continue. All the other bad stuff, and there's so much of it that Iran is doing, that's going to continue. So what is the deal doing? The deal is going to allegedly going to slow down Iran's nuclear program for something like, if you believe the fantasy, 10 or 15 years, and then it'll be kind of just a hop and a skip to get a nuclear weapon. But what we're doing is preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And it's a very narrow arms control kind of nuclear deal. It's just about the nuclear program. Well, there's so many reasons to doubt the stability or the efficacy of this agreement on its own terms as a nuclear weapons control agreement. It's laughable, right? You hear these stories about Iran is going to be responsible for monitoring, for doing its own inspection. It's going to 24 days or so warning to clean up a facility if it's inspected. This is a spot check, right? A spot check is 24 days notice. So many of the features that are coming to light now reveal the incredible appeasing character of this deal, which just gives Iran everything it wants, and we just get to hold a piece of paper. But the crux of it is this evasion of what Iran's actual character is, and the fact that it remains a hostile and militant regime that's continuing to do harm and that continues to threaten us. So it's the kind of fracturing of Iran's character to treat it as if, well, what the real issue is the nuclear issue and all the rest is, you know, it's other problems. Iran is a problem with or without nuclear weapons, and Iran is a problem precisely because of its ideological character and its commitment to waging a war on its religious doctrines, its idea of a jihad and its imperialist ambitions in the region. But all of that is dropped out of the picture because here we have a piece of paper and a bunch of diplomats who are sleep deprived and hopped up on coffee telling us, well, we have achieved it. This is going to be the deal of the century. That is looking at one grain of sand and admiring how shiny it is, while heading for you is a tidal wave of significant conflict and turmoil that you've just turned your gaze away from in the hope that the tidal wave won't come. So, short answer, the Iran deal, no, is a disaster. It is a disaster in the making, and it's going to make things worse not only because it hands Iran so much money, and it's going to release all kinds of funds that have been frozen, which will go, as our administration has admitted, it will go to funding terrorists like Hamas and Hezbollah. It will continue to fund rockets for Hamas to shoot into Israel. All that's going to continue and maybe even get worse precisely because of the deal. But that isn't even the worst part of it, in my view. The worst part of it is the fact that Iran has had not only the invitation to sit at the table, but also the legitimacy that comes with signing a deal. That means, in practice, it is treated as a legitimate regime. It is given an undeserved moral legitimacy. And that is an engine of encouraging it, of giving it greater desire and confidence to continue precisely all the bad things that it's doing that we say, and I believe, has to be stopped. Is this going to make things better? Well, of course not. It's going to make things a lot worse. And at the hinge of it is an evasion of the need to judge regimes morally. So if you want to wrap up kind of a big picture assessment of Obama, and in comparison with Bush and in the context of Bush, which is Bush really caused a disaster in the Middle East. And a big part of it was his foreign policy was predicated on an irrational moral idea, this idea of selfless moral idea, this idea of sacrificing for the liberty of others. This was the animating cause of his foreign policy. And the feature that crippled our military, as I argued earlier. And the ways in which that means Bush was self-deluded and blinded to the actual problems in the region, the actual character of the ideology that people believe there, and the consequences of bringing democracy, which is if people really believe jihad is a good idea or they're very sympathetic to it and you give them the vote, that's going to encourage and strengthen the worst elements, which is precisely what happened. So Bush's policy was informed by those irrational moral ideas, and it caused incredible damage. And Obama's view in its own way is very different from Bush in a number of important features, but in its own way, it is also evasive and ignores the character of the adversary that we're facing, which is Iran and the jihadist movement, which, according to the administration, doesn't really exist. They're just a bunch of extremists, and I use air quotes around that term because I think it's an illegitimate term. There's just a bunch of extremists, and they're a minority, and they're, you know, you've got to tackle that through jobs and social media outreach. Now, that kind of thinking is a denial of the facts and ignoring of the real phenomenon that is plaguing the region. And a whole bunch of magical thinking about what happens if you get a piece of paper signed by the people that are trying to kill you. So in both cases, there's a kind of ignoring of the moral character of what we're dealing with, and a kind of, in Obama's case, an appeasing, guilt-ridden, who are we to insist on advancing our interests? We did that too much last time, which is a gross misconception. So you see, in both cases, an important, I would say, fundamental feature in understanding both sides, is the way in which the moral ideas that are dominant in our culture play out and inform the thinking and the policy decisions of our administration. And in both cases, they cripple us because they lead us to be lacking in self-confidence, lacking in an ability to conceptualize what we're dealing with, the people that we're facing and the enemy and its motives, and what we ought to do and think about better alternatives. I do think Obama's Mideast policy has been destructive. I think it is in its own ways been more destructive than Bush's, but it's a close call because depending on which of their which issues you're looking at, Bush did an incredible amount to encourage the Islamists across the region, and Obama is now coming in and helping one of the worst among the Islamists, the would-be leader of the movement, Iran, become a nuclear power. So there's ways in which they're both accelerating the Islamist rise and encouraging them. I have to think more about where I think one is worse than the other. I think there's a certain way in which Obama's approach has an edge of self-loathing that wasn't as evident in Bush's approach, which is America's done a lot of bad things to you guys, so let us apologize for it. And I think that is not legitimate, even though I think America's done a lot of irrational things in the region. I don't think the premise should be we've done a lot of we're the bad guys here, which is there's an edge to Obama where you see that. And I think it's important to recognize that part of what Obama's argument is and why it's worked in terms of the Iran deal is he can point with some grounds to Iraq and say, you don't want another one of those, right? And nobody, me included, wants another Iraq. So in that respect, Bush has created and shaped the context in a way that that's pushing Obama's view and making it more plausible. Now, it doesn't have any real plausibility, but it makes it plausible by comparison with a false alternative. So there's a way in which we're locked into these false, do you want to be a Bush or do you want to be an Obama? So Bush is not desirable, and the record on Bush is catastrophic, and nor is Obama desirable or appealing, and his is going to lead to catastrophic results. In both cases, they're bad options, but you can see how one plays off the other, and it's inevitable given the record. But what is needed in both cases to sort out what we should be doing, I think it's an important issue, is to see that we needed to be assertive, but Bush failed to do that. And we need to address the Iranian problem, but not through appeasement, which is what Obama is doing. So there's a way in which real problems that need to be addressed, but they were addressed in the worst possible wrong way by both presidents. So what's important is to sort out what are the real issues. And I think Iran is a real issue, and the jihadist movement is a real issue. And how to approach it, what does it look like to assert our own interests? What are our interests? And I would say it's the defense of Americans' lives and property, and essentially it's the advancement of America's individual rights. So we need to be free from foreign threats. And the way to do that is to assert ourselves militarily. Now, the way how you conduct yourself in war, so you have to be really clear on what is an objective threat. What is its scale and how do you eliminate it? And do you have the right morally to do so? And on that last question, the default position is, no, we don't. We're afraid to do it. And that comes even from Bush's administration. And that's a big part of what I think undermined us and what made so many people flock to him, because he seemed like the closest thing to self-assertion, but people didn't really know what it looks like to be self-assertive and advance our interests. So we need a conception of our self-interest. It's not an obvious answer to how to do that, but it means being self-interested and defining that in terms of principles. And the principle is the principle of individual rights, which is not, it might sound obvious to many people when they first hear it, but it is far from obvious. And it is not reflected in Bush, categorically undermined and denied under Obama. So I think we're heading into even murkier and choppier waters in the Middle East. And I think a fundamental reason for that is our foreign policy lacks a conception of our self-interest. Everyone talks about advancing America's interest. That is a placeholder. It doesn't have real meaning unless you have a moral perspective of what our government's purpose is, which is the defense of our individual rights, and what individual rights really look like. Unless you have that conception, you can't really guide foreign policy. And what we're seeing under Bush was the flailing of an irrational moral idea playing out. And under Obama, the negation of that approach, but again, flailing for lack of a coherent, principled approach to foreign policy. I mean, Ayn Rand put it best, I think, in her analysis of political and cultural issues, which is to understand it, you need to know the moral, political, or fundamentally philosophic ideas that are shaping it. And here, foreign policy is such a mess precisely because the lack of a clear philosophic direction. And that means the moral ideas, principally, that they're needed to guide us towards our own interests and our security. Let me draw a line there and turn to a final point I want to mention, looking at the Middle East. So I came up with this idea for a bit of fun. I knew I was going to be talking in the wake of the 14th anniversary of 9/11 today. So I wanted just to change the tone a bit and talk about something else. And this is really more a participatory part of the show, which is I had an idea for a contest and I wanted you to join in. So here's the idea. You might have heard of the show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? So when I came up for the idea for this contest, I had the idea, are you smarter than Donald Trump? And I'm not going to pick on Trump, although there's reasons to pick on him, because I think some of the other candidates are no more appealing. But you might have heard the news that he was on Hugh Hewitt's radio show, and he was asked a question that he felt was a gotcha question. It was unfair, and people were pointing to this as evidence of Trump's lack of foreign policy knowledge. And I don't think that's what it shows. I think there's more evidence of his lack of knowledge of a lot of issues than you don't need this show to point that out. But here's the contest. And the way you take part is through Twitter, so I'll explain that in a minute. But the basic idea is that I'm going to ask you a question, and the first person who tweets the right answer to me after the show, so after we finish this broadcast, I will look on Twitter and see who was the first to send the right answer. I will send you a copy of my book, Winning the Unwinnable War, and I'll autograph it if you want and mail it to you. And the basic question is this: what is the name of the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guards force? Now, there's a special force elite group called the Quds Force, and that's the head of that force. Who is the head of the Quds Force, which is a subsection of the Revolutionary Guards? Now, it might sound like a super technical inside baseball kind of question, but it has a direct bearing on the point I made regarding Donald Trump, because I think he was asked this question: what do you think of this guy? And he was stumped. I don't think he'd ever heard of him. He got the question wrong. So this is more of a question for you guys to see, do you follow the news? And I didn't pick it idly or simply because of the Trump gotcha question, because I think if you have not heard of him, you should, because this person, the head of the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, Quds Force, is an important figure in understanding what happened in Iraq, what's happening in Syria, and what's going to happen in the future. I actually talk about him in my book, in one of the chapters where I analyze the supposed successes of Iraq in the later part of Bush's administration. So I think he's an important figure, and understanding his function in the region reveals a number of things about Iran's goals, its reach, influence, both in Iraq and in other parts of the region. So first listener, and I hope you're excited to get a copy of my book, I hope you will Google this if you don't know the answer and then read up on this person. Tweet me the right answer, just his name. I don't really mind the spelling so long as I can discern the right person. And you can tweet me. My handle is at Elan Journo, ELANJOURNO. And you have, whoever's first to answer that. And then I'll announce the winner on my Twitter account if you're interested, if you're wondering if you made it first or not. So the basic question, just to repeat, is who is the head of the Quds Force, the elite faction of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. First person to tweet that at me will win a copy of my book, autographed and personalized to you. Now, if anyone wants to do bonus questions, and I'll, if you want to do that, a bonus question is, if you can find it where in my book I mention him, that would be a bonus point. But you don't have to tweet that. All right, I hope you will take part. I'm interested to see whether you guys have heard of him too, and if you have not heard of him, whether you found it illuminating to look him up, because I think it is quite interesting to see what significance he has in the region. So before we close today's show, I want to mention a couple of quick things. Later this month, on September 29th, I will be in New York City. The Ayn Rand Institute is hosting a gala event called the Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner. It is a really exciting event. Yaron Brook is going to be the keynote speaker, and we have a number of other guest speakers. There is an auction of some interesting materials related to Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. And the event is, I think it's been happening for the last 5 years or so. It's always a thrilling event because we've had some electrifying speakers. You can hear one of them online or on our YouTube channel speaking about the impact of Atlas Shrugged on his own life. I think he's a pretty young guy. He's in grad school, MBA in financial industry. And just listening to his story was inspiring to me. And I've read Atlas Shrugged numerous times. So if you are in the New York City area, or if you're not and willing to travel, September 29th, there is a gala dinner, Atlas Shrugged Revolution Dinner. I hope you can join me and some of my colleagues in New York City. It's at the St. Regis. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I think Yaron Brook is back on the show next week. So if you've missed him, he'll be back, and I'm sure he's going to be glad to join you. I've had fun talking to you guys, and I will talk to you next time. It's been a pleasure. This has been the Yaron Brook Show. I'm Ilan Jurno, and I look forward to seeing your contest entries on Twitter. Thanks a lot.